Welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. As always, our weekly conversations include you, and the phone lines are open, 941-3689, 941-3689. If you call from Oahu, that's the number. Or if you are calling us from the neighbor islands or listening to the live stream, you can get to us at 877-941-3689. Well, this week we found out that for the moment, the U.S. will engage in diplomatic efforts with Syria and not airstrikes. Whether that diplomacy was a year in the making, that course of action is consistent with the polls showing Americans are opposed to military intervention, 63% and 64% respectively in the surveys from Pew USA and the ABC Washington Post. As divisions over a possible future U.S. strike in Syria continue to pull perspectives into opposite corners, a Hawaii scholar says that whether we will or won't take that action shouldn't be the first question. That one should be which branch of government has the power to declare war. Matsunaga Institute for Peace scholar and author Brian Hallett joined us last week on the conversation to look at what he says a few in general really want to look at, that congressional incapacity to declare war. He's just released another in a series of papers challenging the belief of only three primary functions of government, legislative, executive, and judicial. He's also proposed a constitutional amendment to establish a fourth branch of government dedicated to the declaring of war and the treating of peace, and also major reform in Congress to establish a joint drafting committee dedicated to drafting declarations of war, modeled on the 1776 Declaration of Independence. Tonight on Town Square, declaring war and keeping the peace with Brian Hallett. Welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me back.
Well, you know, the little conversation that we had on the conversation last week, Thursday, a week ago, sparked phone calls, and people asked me, well, you can have a longer conversation about this. This needs more breath. Well, you know, we agreed. So if you are one of the folks who called, well, you can do that now, too, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. In part of our conversation, we set up what we've seen traditionally happen. The president goes to Congress and says, we should go to war. And Congress usually agrees.
Always agrees.
Yeah. Without a whole lot of real discussion about that once you get to that point. This time around, when the president was saying, well, you know, I'm going to do this if I want to do this because I can do this, and that's the way it's going to be. And then retrenches a little bit and it's back to, well, maybe we need to get congressional buy-in. And the fact that Congress has actually been debating about this, and not necessarily strictly along partisan apportionments, but how that discussion has been running might make you wonder if they're trying to take a little bit of that power back and not necessarily just trying to be a bit of a pain for the rest of us to have to go through and have the president...
No, the way I see it, well, back up a little bit. For the last 200 years, presidents have used one of two plans. They've either been involved in a war that is small or not controversial, in which case they just go ahead and they totally ignore Congress. So a small war would be like the 2011 Libya operation, where Obama supported the no-fly zone. And he produced legal documents that said Libya was not a war. Therefore, the Congress had no role to play. And Libya was not hostilities. The really strange thing about it is that he was on very, very strong legal grounds for saying that, which just shows you how confused our laws have become on this. He started out on that track. I'm going to do it. Going to bomb Syria. Red lines have been crossed. It's all over. The second plan that presidents use is for controversial wars or very large wars, World War I, World War II. They prepare the ground, and then when it comes to the point where the Congress cannot refuse their request, they make the request. The classic example is James Polk in 1846. He waited until General Taylor had attacked the Mexicans. General Taylor sent a telegram back saying the Mexicans had attacked. Polk immediately went to Congress, and Congress, of course, you know, gave him what his things. World War II, Roosevelt waited until Pearl Harbor. After Pearl Harbor, he couldn't be refused. Obama, because of what happened in the British Parliament, when the British Parliament refused to give Prime Minister Cameron authority to join the Americans, I think that was the crucial moment. It destroyed Plan 1, and he had to go to Plan 2, but he hadn't prepared the ground.
But there's some controversy whether he did prepare the ground or not. I mean, the stance,
from my point of view,
that this wasn't a long conversation that happened at G20 about whether we should go in at it from a diplomatic perspective.
Because of all the confusion that's happened since, I think it's pretty well proven that he didn't prepare the ground. Well, you have to think of George Bush in 2003. In October of 2002, 2 weeks before the midterm election, he sent the request to invade Iraq. 2 weeks before the midterm election. The congressman had to give it to him. Otherwise, they didn't support the troops. Bush built the case up. It was weapons of mass destruction, terrorism. It was very, very rhetorically, as a public relations campaign, it was very, very powerful. Whether it was true or not is irrelevant. It was powerful. He waited for the moment just before the election, when all the members of Congress were distracted by the election, and the last thing they needed in the election was to be told by the opposition that they didn't support the troops that were gathering. So the president's always prepare the ground and ask for the request when it's virtually impossible for the Congress.
But not in this case.
No, he completely flubbed the whole thing. I mean, this has become Gilbert and Sullivan. I mean, this is a farce.
I mean, there are some who are saying that this was orchestrated long ago. I mean, the idea that there would be almost a red herring, set it up for some sort of strike and really be working the diplomatic channels behind scenes, and that had been going on since the G20 last year, and that the idea was, let Kerry say what he will, throw it up and see if it sticks against the wall. Great. Then obviously we'll just realign with that. And despite all of the talk that somehow, Kerry was set now at odds with the president, that really hasn't been the scenario as was envisioned. Truth is, we may never know exactly what scenario was envisioned and who is sidestepping what and how they're realigning or recombining efforts to do something. Yeah. But still, the way in which others perceive the United States seems to be the bigger issue. And how the United States is playing on the world stage seems to be where we find ourselves wondering, is it a good thing? Is it not a good thing? Is the president being perceived as being a true leader?
No, he's not being perceived as a true leader. It's just too confused. He's the first president to do this. It's just simply impossible to know what's going to happen. I mean, this Russian ploy, Putin publishing in the New York Times. I mean, he's got to be the first Russian leader to do that, or maybe the second. I can't remember, but
I think there have been others who have done, or at least the positioning. I mean, obviously, he didn't write it. Somebody wrote it for him, and he's got his name slapped on it. But there have been others who have done that, even going back to the Cold War days.
Yeah, but it's very unusual, and it's a stunning diplomatic move. And, Putin, I mean, he would come out smelling like a rose if they can pull this off, if they can actually get the chemical agents out of Syria or put them under some kind of control. It's an enormous logistic problem. It's an enormous political problem.
Which sort of makes you wonder how real or perhaps disingenuous that whole line of thinking would be because of what would have to happen for it to come to fruition.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is mind-boggling. I can't see the way forward. It's just gotten so confused. So confused. And what's being lost in all this is the original problem. There still is a civil war going on. And essentially is what we have done is we've distracted ourselves from the real problem. And we're tying ourselves up in knots with this very exciting diplomatic drama that's going on, this very exciting drama with the Congress. Day by day, minute by minute, it changes. It's really very absorbing. But the Syrians are still fighting, and we're not an inch closer to solving that real problem. So, in many ways, this is a distraction. Andrew Bracevich has a large blog post on The Nation where he makes this case very strongly.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Brian Hallett from the Matsunaga Institute for Peace. Tonight we're talking about Syria, yes, but also some of the machinations of the United States and what would need to happen for us to be engaged militarily, and the way in which Dr. Hallett says we go about doing things now wasn't the way that it was originally intended to function, and that maybe we ought to reconsider that and also reconsider our branches of government, possibly even adding a fourth. We want to hear what you have to say. 941-3689, 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, that's the number to call. And from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, 877-941-3689. You know, you can't go any place without turning on a radio or a TV with Syria blasting right out at you. But your point that you made just a moment ago is that although we may be talking about Syria, really we should be talking about ourselves and looking at how we go forward in this campaign or others, and if this is in fact the best and proper way in which the process should function. You've made the case in several of your papers and both of your books that three branches of government, that's all very nice, but that has really not a lot to do with war and the keeping of peace, and that perhaps we need to have a fourth branch of government.
Right.
Why?
Well, because foreign affairs is an independent, complex problem that requires its own specialization. The function of the legislature is to make domestic laws. Domestic laws are really irrelevant to foreign affairs in many ways. The function of the president is to execute the laws, and he should be executing a foreign policy that is made by someone else. And it's what I'm trying to do is be very clear about the difference between making policy and executing policy. And is what they did in 1789 when they wrote the Constitution is they took all the foreign affairs policies or problems, powers, and they gave some of them to the executive and some of them to the legislature, and it's all very confused. There has to be a central point where foreign policy is made, and then the president executes.
Well, if that's what they did then, there will be many who would say to you, well, shouldn't we just carry on?
Well, I would suggest to you that what is happening now over Syria is proof positive that we can't carry on. The Congress has tied itself up into incredible knots on domestic issues, and the president comes along and says, untie yourself from the domestic problems that you're worrying about, and now talk about Syria. In order to talk intelligently about Syria, you have to know Syrian history. You have to know Middle East history. You have to know Cold War history. You have to have some sense about how nations are built and unbuilt. You have to have some ideas about the imaginative constitutions that work in transitional situations. And no member of Congress has any time to do that.
And maybe not even the inclination to have to amass that necessary and presumed knowledge.
The model here would be the judiciary. The model here would be the judiciary. The Congress makes the laws. The president executes the laws. But you really need a special body with a special type of knowledge on how to adjudicate the laws. And we have a specialized body, the courts, that do that. So we need to be clearer about our functions and who does which function. And the present situation, ignoring the rest of American history, I think is a perfect example of how foreign policy, when it's spread out between the executive and the legislature, no one takes responsibility for it. It falls through the crack, and you get a mess like we have now.
A lot of major infighting.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, everything that you're trying to affect with foreign policy may be simply going by the wayside.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right, we have several callers on the line. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, that's the number to use. And elsewhere, including on the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. We're talking about Syria, possibly what happens in the future, and what we've seen over the last week. Going now to Nancy, calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Nancy. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, thank you. I'm floored sometimes by what's going on with what our quote-unquote government is doing these days. It seems like the rich bankers have taken everything from us, and now we're all hiding, waiting for the end of the world. Nobody's talking about Fukushima. They're talking about Syria, and it's like Fukushima may destroy the entire planet, but the focus is somewhere else. The U.S. government has allowed its own people to be gassed by radiation on a continual basis and has looked the other way while they frack the whole world and make water not drinkable or usable. And it's like, what can you say? It's like there used to be statesmen and brilliant people in the government or near the government, and now it seems like when corporations were made individuals, now everything's at stake because money's been taken away from everything. Schools don't have books. They're dumbing down the American public, and it's just, it's something that needs to be spoken about. Maybe some rich person with a philanthropic bent would get a newspaper out there that would start throwing some light on this stuff for the general public, because no one believes in anything anymore.
Nancy, you also seem to be making the point that we are inconsistent with our own beliefs and values as we put them out to the world.
Yes, very much, very much. And part of that is because nobody's in charge of what we say to the rest of the world. It's split between the Congress. To comment on Nancy's what Nancy said, I'm an incurable optimist, and whilst everything she said is absolutely true, read the newspaper. I think things are changing. I think things are moving forward.
But you have to look kind of way back there,
yeah.
Like page 10.
Page 10, maybe page 12. I mean, we have finally gotten a national health care bill through. People are finally realizing the income inequality. People are pushing back on some of these fracking and other issues. So I don't think we need to be that pessimistic. I think we're still moving forward.
Some of it is going back to that old idea of, you know, you get more of what you pay attention to. That doesn't mean you stick your head in the sand. You're just going to see a bunch of sand. But otherwise, you're saying we've got to be looking a little bit more broadly than we do and not just focusing on the problems. But you're also saying, though, that we have a major systemic issue that may allow us to tread water for many more years, but it's still going to be there. Do you see our government as being at the point where it will no longer be able to function, just forgetting the money part of the moment, but just the way in which the process works? It's so bogged down, so wrapped up in itself, and so convoluted that moving forward is, in some cases, just miraculous.
Well, actually, I argue, speaking specifically of the Congress, I argue that the governmental system is working. It's working exactly the way it was designed to work, which is to say there is a large number of people out there who are very, very upset with the way the government has been operating. They organized themselves, they elected representatives, and they're representing their point of view. And is what we are seeing now is this titanic clash between points of views and values, and the Constitution was set up to create conflict. It was set up to create conflict, but conflict within certain boundaries. And, you know, we're having that titanic debate about how much we should be taxed, how little we should be taxed, whether the government should do this, whether the government should be doing that. And my optimistic feeling is that as we work our way through this debate, the way the Constitution says we should work our way through, we'll come to a reasonable, agreement at the end.
With the exception of foreign policy.
Yeah, I think there's a major structural issue in foreign policy. The structural issue is nobody's paying attention to it full time.
Well, we are tonight, and so are some of our callers. And if you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689. If you call from Oahu, that's the number to use, or 877-941-3689. If you're listening to us on the Neighbor Islands or the live stream from someplace else. Going now to Russell calling us from Waikiki. I'm sorry, Waikoloa. Russell,
good
are you
afternoon.
There? Hi yeah. there.
Good evening.
Thank you for your patience.
You know, the situation we were discussing initially with Syria, after being in civil war for 2 years, you've created a fertile ground for the al-Qaeda and terrorist mentality where they can go in and annihilate and assassinate everyone who does not agree with them, whether they're for the Syrian government or the rebels against the Syrian government. When you create that kind of environment, you've got people that are just dying left and right, children, women, people uninvolved, the civilian population, because the terrorists don't care, and the rebels don't know who the heck to fire at, and of course then you have the Syrian regime that just wants to put everybody down. In regard to your consideration about validating Putin's position, how can we validate a government that has a history of its own genocide? Routine every dozen years or so, they've gone in and annihilate a population. To even validate that at the UN Security Council level is just ludicrous. I just don't see that. And then you have China in there, not to put them down, but gee, they did the same thing. They took bats and clubs and, you know, just the Tibetan monks while the Korean War was going on. There's always something going on with the left hand. Don't look at the right hand, what it's doing. And that's what we see going on here in the U.S. Congress, the elitist mentality within the government itself, and you can see the progression of changes in the U.S. Constitution. You've given themselves their own purse strings. You've given them their own right to promote their own survival better than the American people who have put them into office. Look at how much money into the substructure.
All right, let me get Dr. Hall to answer you on some of the issues that you've brought up. He brought up many, many issues, from the fact that China and certainly Russia can't be viewed as being honest brokers, to the fact that you have what is happening in Syria, not knowing who to fire at, who are the good guys or the bad guys. We're really kind of caught with all of this and looking at how do we engage in any meaningful diplomacy with anyone there.
Well, the first part of his comments is what really caught my eye about how the civil war has been going on for 2 years and all these bad people have been coming in, and how do you sort that out? That's the problem we should be discussing. How do you sort that out? And in order to sort it out, you have to make an enormous commitment in men and money. And that is the discussion that we are not having.
The question is, though, who are you going to have that discussion with in Syria if everyone is equally unable to have it?
For America, the discussion has to be in America. What resources are we willing to commit
That's a different discussion as opposed to who are you going to have something with over there, which is what I think a little bit of what Russell was saying, that if you have people who have been doing this for a couple of years, how do you trust anyone to have a meaningful discussion for a diplomatic solution?
No, I look at it differently. In America, we need to have a discussion about what resources are we going to put on the ground in order to corral all those bad people. Now, after Petraeus came in Iraq, we tried to do that in Iraq. And we can discuss whether it was successful or not. But we either make a decision to put the resources into Iraq with our allies, they have to be a part of it, to sort the good guys from the bad. I mean, you go in and you sort them out.
Do you mean Iraq or Syria?
Well,
either.
Both. I mean, well, let me back up. Dictatorships are very good at maintaining order, but they're fragile. And when they break, there's a vacuum and all this stuff comes in. Well, the only way you can restore order in a vacuum is to put resources in, to put men and equipment in. And it takes a large amount of men and equipment. And are we going to make the commitment to do that? Probably not. Or are we not? That's the policy decision that has to be made in America.
When I talked to Colleen Hanabusa earlier this week,
yeah,
she made the point that, you know, the studies that we're seeing, the Pew study, yeah, and the Washington Post study, were just really reflective of what many of her fellows were hearing from their constituents,
right,
that this was not a road,
right,
we wanted to go down, period.
Right.
End of subject.
Yeah.
Seemingly, regardless of whatever horrific, heinous things were going on,
right,
that was not a way in which they were comfortable to have the United States proceed. So that puts us in a very sticky place to say we feel this is a horrible thing to have anyone gassed, and certainly to say that from the Second World War on, we're not willing to do that. That was not to be used. And yet to say, well, if it requires that we actually put boots on the ground and commit resources to that, well, then maybe we're not willing to do that. Do you see some hypocrisy in any of this?
No. Hypocrisy in government. We don't want to talk about that. No, it's what I see is a need to make a decision.
But aren't they saying that they would like the decision to be no regardless?
Well,
I mean,
if
you've got 63-64% of those polled who said no military intervention.
Yeah. Well, you see, my constitutional problem is there is no place where this conversation happens. The Congress is incapable of having this discussion. The Congress is incapable. I go back to the Second Continental Congress in 1776. Some people thought we ought to go for independence. Some people thought we shouldn't go to independence. There was a place where this conversation could take place, where this debate could be taken, an official place that would eventually come to a vote. And that doesn't exist in the United States for foreign policy. It exists for domestic policy. It exists for... Take the health care bill. Truman was the first one to propose a national health care. And finally, Barack Obama forced the Congress to debate this question seriously. And it could have gone either way. As it turned out, the vote was for the bill we have. But there's no place to have this. There's no political place. There's no constitutional place where we can discuss foreign affairs.
That's solely and absolutely devoted only,
right,
to that.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take some more callers. If you want to join us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Lots of callers on the line. Don't wait too long. We'll get you through if we can. Going to Marty calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Marty. Thanks for your patience.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I think this issue has been so compartmentalized. We're not attending the United Nations Charter. We signed on to this deal. Even the threat of force against an independent nation who's not threatening us, this is a violation of international law. The United States is acting like a rogue state. We do whatever we want. All this talk about chemical weapons, the United States has stockpiles of chemical weapons. They used them in Vietnam. In Fallujah, the birth defect rates are through the roof. The radiation there from the DU we use is killing and deforming children. No one's talking about that. It's always Assad. It's always the terrorists, the bad guys. You know, and what does our domestic law allow? What should we do? We're bound by the international conventions that we've signed on to. And the United States has no accountability. Washington does whatever it wants.
Well, that sort of goes back to the point about doing what the nation sees as being politically expedient, and the fact that perhaps, as I asked Dr. Hallett a moment ago, are we putting out to the world beliefs and values that really aren't reflected in our behavior?
Yes.
Those beliefs and values are for public consumption. It's for suckers. We have been played by our government. It belongs to corporations. When we talk about this health care law, he's pushed through health care reform. No, that's not what's happened. This is a fascist collaboration with the insurance company. The United States government is going to subsidize insurance companies to cover the cost of taking care of our citizens. It's not economically viable. It's not rational. Our country is no longer ours. This is not a democracy. Yeah, government works, but it doesn't work for the citizens. It works for big corporations.
All right, Marty. So what are you going to do about it? I mean, we're all talking about this and saying where are the proper places for us to be having this conversation specifically about foreign policy.
Well,
Dr. Hallett says we don't really have a place where that national conversation needs to happen.
Well, that's my problem. The conversation isn't happening. Even, you know, the major news outlets, NPR included, are not reporting honestly on what our government is doing. When we go on and on about what Assad's done and what we're going to do, President Obama's threats against Assad are a violation of international law. Just the threats are a violation. We violated international law when we attacked Iraq, and we left millions dead and displaced.
All right, I want to get Dr. Hallett into this conversation.
Law in Afghanistan, and if Marty, our media outlets don't hold our government accountable, that's y'all's job.
Okay,
is to stand up and say,
"Hey, I hear what you're saying. I really do." But I want to get Dr. Hallett into this conversation too. You've heard him make several points, some of which you look like you had you were agreeing with, and some you had some disagreements with.
Well, first of all, I want to defend the media. I think the conversation does take place in the media. You got to search around a little bit to find it. My point is that there's no place in the government, there's no place in the Constitution where these international policies are thrashed out. With respect to international law, international law and international law and international law. The Charter of the United Nations was written, saying that the use and threat of armed force was no longer allowed. But then there's Article 51 that allows self-defense, which is the escape clause. And everything every country has done since the Charter is in the pursuit of self-defense. So there's The escape clause in Article 51 sort of takes the teeth out of this part of international law. Moreover, the Security Council, although we have enshrined it with this so-called legal power, it really is an alliance coordinating committee. The big five powers coming out of World War II essentially made a deal that they would coordinate in their conduct of foreign policy and their conduct of how the government or how the world was run. And when the five great powers agree to do something, it's done. And when the five powers can't agree to do something, it's not done. You know, it's a coordinating committee, coordinating policy with the five great powers. And in the absence of the agreement in the Security Council, individual states have to act because there's just no alternative. Bosnia and Kosovo are the principal examples of that recently. Korea, I think, is an excellent example. The Persian Gulf War is another excellent example. The sovereignty of the individual national states, although everyone says it's been abraded and it's no longer what it used to be, which is probably true, they're still sovereign. And sovereign states do what sovereign states are going to do. And there's just no way for it not to be that way.
All right, we're going to take some more calls. The phone lines are open, 941-3689, 941-3689, or 877-941-3689. My guest is Matsunaga Institute for Peace scholar and author Brian Hallett. Going now to Matt, calling us from Eva Beach. Aloha, Matt. Thanks for your patience.
Aloha. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a little confused by the idea of a fourth branch of government and the idea there's not a place to have these conversations. I think the conversations are taking place. They're just taking place by people who have been influenced by interests that are not just in the interest of the people, but, you know, there's a military-industrial complex who gives lots of money to these representatives to share their views, frankly. And, you know, it doesn't seem realistic to have an idea to rewrite the Constitution with a fourth branch of government if the people who are going to have to do the work are those with the moneyed interests to keep things in the status quo. Is there a more realistic proposal you have?
All right. I knew you were waiting for somebody to ask you that question because it's one that you hear certainly quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, the political reality at the moment is that my suggestion for fourth branch of government is a dead letter. I mean, obviously, we're not going to amend the Constitution tomorrow. However, I believe that we have to start generating the ideas, and then we'll build the momentum. It seems to me that we need a dedicated place within the constitutional framework. I mean, you're absolutely correct. The conversations are taking place, but they're taking place in unofficial venues. They're taking place not even in the Committee of Foreign Affairs hearing rooms. And what we need is, you know, something on the model of the judiciary, a dedicated body that is focused on foreign affairs and takes foreign affairs very seriously. This body, I might add, would not have the power of the purse, so that they would not be influenced by money directly because they don't have any money to give anybody.
And are you saying that this should be extracted from congressional oversight in any way?
Yeah.
And that it would also have different terms. It would be a completely separate autonomous entity.
Yeah.
And we would, in a way, function somewhat like a Supreme Court, being away from it and not being subject to the same kinds of...
I think the Congress should focus on domestic legislation, and the president should focus on execution and not policymaking, and that leaves a hole in the Constitution is who makes foreign policy, and I want to plug that hole. And then you have the judiciary that sort of sorts everything out between the branches.
Matt, you had a follow-up question?
Yeah, and it was on the Putin letter to the editor at the New York Times. You know, I'm really confused by a lot of the reaction in this country.
Well, first of all, did you read it?
I read portions of it, yes. I didn't get a chance to read the whole thing on my way to work this morning. But I know that the part of the argument, and this was on NPR this morning, was that, look, it's a violation of international law if you do this. And one of your callers was on and on about international law, this and that. Well, there's a big difference between the law and justice. And to have the president of Russia write in the New York Times that if you do this, it's a violation of international law, as if that's a real reason, because the only reason it's a violation is because he's vetoing it.
Right.
And so here you have the guy who's vetoing it, making it illegal, and who won't do it. And the reason that, right, you know, the argument for doing it is, you know, justin bello, jus ad bellum, and the fact that, you know, we have the ability to stop a humanitarian crisis,
right,
and therefore we have an obligation to do it. And he's making it illegal by vetoing it.
Yeah.
And I'm just really astounded and kind of ashamed of some of my fellow Americans for being so war-weary that they can't see when it is just and right to get involved in something. And just because we screwed up in Iraq doesn't mean that we should be cowards when it comes to saving people who need our help. And I just wanted to say that, so thank you.
Well, I'm glad you did. There's another idea that we haven't explored yet with regard to the letter that was in the New York Times this morning, that really it wasn't really meant to be a shining example of what we should be doing if we're following international law. It was meant to be a gotcha and, in a way, a bit of an embarrassment, and to push the president into a position to make him even more uncomfortable and to, you know, further the situation where yeah. they have a lot, they, the Russian perspective, has a lot more control over what happens next, and to put a little egg on our face.
Yeah, exactly. And the irony is that if this works, Putin becomes the hero, right? It's daunting to make it work, both on the logistics and the politics side. And, you know, frankly, I wish him the best on this, because if the chemical agents can be taken out of Syria, it solves that problem.
But that's a really big if.
Oh, well.
Because you're talking about some real logistical problems with that, because
yeah.
how do you move that? I mean, physically, how do you move that stuff away without having perhaps injury happening or a major disaster?
Well,
I mean, mustard gas, those are all pretty nasty things. Some yeah. could be contained pretty well. Some would have to be disposed of right there, wouldn't they?
Well, of course, I don't know. I don't know the tech. I assume that these agents are stored in precursor, so that in the individual barrels are not so toxic. It's when you mix them that it become toxic. So theoretically, you could move.
But we don't know this until we really
yeah.
know this, right?
So it's all iffy, and it's all hypothetical, and I have absolutely no crystal ball.
Nor does anyone, but we're yeah. talking about it tonight to see what scenarios might be possible. Matt, thanks very much for the call.
Yeah.
I mean, the overwhelming sentiment that he expresses is the fact that you've got to be able to separate the weariness just because you've
right.
been engaged in warfare for a long time from the fact that something else, another campaign, might be
right.
just. And are we having that conversation, or is it simply a matter of not even going there because everyone simply just doesn't want to have that
conversation? If I was going to criticize Matt, the only point I'd criticize him on is what we really need to discuss is the civil war and how to stop it. You know, that's the underlying problem. And in a certain sense, these chemical agents are a distraction from the real problem.
Which, again, you say is going to require truly boots on the ground and a commitment.
Enormous resources, yeah.
All right. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone lines are open, 941-3689. If you're calling from Oahu, that's the number to use. And from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Going now to Glenn, calling us from Makiki. Aloha, Glenn.
Aloha, Bethan and Professor Hallett. I'm on the one of those who wanted him to have an opportunity to clarify the fourth branch idea and how a decision should be made in a democracy to engage in war. I might just preface this to a quote of General MacArthur, who said that until war is abolished, the next great advance in civilization can't be taken place. Now, Matt, when Professor Hallett responded to Matt, I got a clearer idea, but the question would be, how are these judiciary-oriented war or peacemakers to be selected? What qualifications are they to?
Okay, so if I'm understanding your question, Glenn, you'd like to have a fuller description of what Dr. Hallett would see in that fourth branch of government, where it would come from.
Yeah, and I want to make another point before.
Sure, why don't you do that now, and then we're going to ask him to give you a fuller explanation.
Yes, because I think the Constitution is very clear about who makes war and the decision. The Constitution says we, the people of the United States, right, formulate the Constitution between 1787 and 91. And when it was set up, they didn't want a king because kings were engaging in war. They didn't want a king. They wanted a fairly weak presidency. They didn't want a House of Lords or a parliament that would be making wars and so forth. And they didn't want a common law. Very clear. They wanted a clear constitution and things specified. Plus, they wanted a Bill of Rights. They didn't want a king, and they didn't want a
right. They wanted a republic. And the question is, can we still keep it at this date?
They wanted, and the people are the power.
All right. So let me get you an answer from Dr. Hallett. So she's specifically asking you, where and how would this be created with a fourth branch of government? And where in the Constitution would you have that reside given the original intent?
Well, there'd be an amendment that would establish a fourth branch of government. And my ideas, I'm not saying that they're the cast in concrete, is that it would be a body of 50 people. And I would like to have these 50 people elected by the state legislatures the way senators were before 1913. And the idea there is that the state legislatures would provide a geographic and an interest, a variety of geographic influences and interests on this group. And the state legislatures, I assume, would elect favorite sons, ambassadors, military men, governors, prominent business people. And they would be a group of representatives of the states, of the nations, of the different parts of the country. And they would come together, and their full-time job would be foreign affairs. For example, the United States should have an official declaration of war against Zimbabwe now. The relationships between the United States and Zimbabwe are not good. We have economic sanctions, targeted economic sanctions on their leadership. We have diplomatic policies that try to change the situation in Zimbabwe. I don't think we give any foreign affairs to Zimbabwe because we disagree with the way that it's working there. We have very, very unfriendly relationships with Zimbabwe. This creates a state of war. And instead of having a vague, our relationships with Zimbabwe are not good, we need a formal declaration that explains what we are upset about, what are our grievances against the government in Zimbabwe, and what we plan to do about it, what the remedies are. So this should be a body that should constantly be reviewing American foreign policy, reviewing treaties on the peace side. And when relationships between the United States and these various countries become unfriendly, they should declare that they're unfriendly and the degree of unfriendly and what our policy would be. Most of these declarations of war would have absolutely nothing to do with military responses.
It's really basically a statement of the health or ill health of that relationship.
And what think about Cuba. We've essentially been at war since President Eisenhower threw on the sugar embargo in, 1959? Something like that. Does anybody want to say, from the Cuban perspectives, they're at war with the United States? We even tried to invade them.
But what about that word war, though? Because that seems to have a whole different connotation for most people, as opposed to saying, we can be enemies, but that doesn't mean I'm going to war with you.
Yeah.
And what does that mean to go to war? For most people, that means some sort of military intervention.
Right. Yeah, and that's a big, big problem for me because I obviously don't think of war in terms of violence and armed.
Right, so you're asking us to look at war perhaps
much
a little
broadly.
Bit differently. Let's take a few more phone calls as we're coming up to the top of the hour. Michael calling us from Manoa. Aloha, Michael. Thank you for your patience.
Aloha. Thank you. Beth Ann, I have to agree with you. that is a very laden word emotionally, war. But in due respect to you, Doctor, I think it that the word war has the necessary clarity that everyone would recognize a national state of emergency and the mobilization necessary to embark on an adventure against another country for various reasons. The term unfriendly, and they don't like us, so we have to declare war against them. I don't think it's going to stand too very well. It's an interesting idea to have a fourth branch of government. Perhaps that should be kicked around a little bit further. I would have a couple of questions here, but in terms of clarity and language, the inability of Congress to make a declaration of war, I think, has to do with the fact that Congress is tasked with making war, and they're not tasking, they're not being tasked constitutionally, at least, with a limited police action or so-called surgical strike or all of these different words that could indicate something, which is very much an act of war. But the president, because of the powers that we've acceded to the office, somehow has the ability to cloak these aggressive military actions in some sort of soothing language that doesn't raise the issue. Second issue I would ask about clarity is in terms of chemical weapons in the present situation in Syria. I just wonder what sort of moral ground that we stand upon when war crimes and atrocities are being mentioned, depleted uranium as a munition stock, which is going to poison the environment in Iraq for hundreds, if not several thousands of years. That is considered a war crime, in my understanding, and we are not a signatory, at least when I last checked, to the International Criminal Court. So our moral high ground, I don't see where we have it.
Right. It's going back to this idea of the stance that we've taken in the world against certain things when it's particularly expedient to take that stance, but not necessarily in sync with all of our actions.
Yeah, well, this comes up. On the depleted uranium, I happen to think that we probably should not use depleted uranium. However, depleted uranium has been acknowledged under the Hague treaties. So there's no legal prohibition about using depleted uranium. Although I personally think it's a bad idea. I forget the first part of the question. Do you remember?
Honestly, no, at this moment. I'm sorry. It flew out of my head, and I think we've lost Michael. Right? Okay. Well, sorry about that.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens if we can get that question back. Michael, if you have it, quickly, briefly ask him that question, David, and then ferry it over to us if he calls us right back.
Hello?
Michael, you still here?
Yeah, I'm there.
Oh, I thought we lost you. Okay, the first part, very, very succinctly, because we're running out of time.
Okay.
The first part of your question.
In terms of clarity, all right?
Yeah.
Using the word war,
yeah,
settles the issue. It clears the air.
Right.
Okay? We are going to mobilize on a national emergency basis.
Okay. Okay.
On an adventure, and substituting surgical strike or intervention or something that is an act of war and not calling it war,
yeah,
is what's leading us into this impasse, I might say.
Yeah.
Right. It's just putting some nice euphemisms on it, and maybe we should just call it as clearly as we can. But being very clear when you're using that word, as opposed to perhaps just using it in the way you were asking us to consider it more broadly, a statement of health or lack of good health in the situation with another country and the relationship with another country. We want to take one more caller here. We're going to go to John calling us from Kalihi. Aloha, John. We're running a little short of time, so I'll ask you to be brief.
Well, I'll try to make it simple. As we have the best democracy that corporate money can buy, is it actually realistic that we can actually have a people's democracy ever again?
Okay, good question. Now, forgive me if I'm preempting you, but I bet you're going to tell us that once upon a time, we didn't think we could do away with slavery either.
Yeah. Yeah. And for 5,000 years, all societies around the world had had slaves. So it's obviously impossible to have a society without slaves. In the at the end of the 19th century in England, and then early 19th century in the United States, people started talking about abolition, and it was a crazy idea. But they had newspapers, and they had the discussion, and they moved the debate along, and eventually we did away with slavery.
And your point is that if we wanted to really reform our government, that although it might be a long and arduous task, we could still do it if we wanted to. We just have to do it piece by piece.
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
And in doing the piece by piece, you'd like to see that fourth branch of government created only to look at foreign policy.
And I'd like to have a very, very rigorous, you know, discussion, debate of that leading up to.
Well, we would most likely get that. The question is, where would we be having some of those discussions, and how would that process look?
That's my next problem, and this program is one of the first steps to do that. Bring it out in the public, talk to it about it in public radio. I've published two books now on this. I'll publish a third book soon, and we'll talk to people, conferences, and so on and so forth.
I'll make you a deal. When you do that, you'll come back and we'll have another hour's discussion, because this is one of those evolving conversations. No one conversation is ever meant to be the be-all, end-all, whether it's in a longer format for an hour or whether it's in the shorter conversation that we had last week that engendered this longer program. There's still another conversation to have, but your whole point about it is we've got to be able to extract that foreign policy conversation and move it to a, in your mind, a rightful place.
Right. Yes, ma'am.
Dr. Hallett, thank you so much
for
being here
me.
With us. It's going to be a pleasure. I got to ask you one more question, though. If you had to prognosticate just a little bit, given what you've seen this week, if we were to talk to each other in a couple of months, what's the situation look like for the United States position on Syria?
In Syria? I think we probably will not bomb. I think this diplomatic effort will, it's enormous, but maybe I don't think, I pray that this diplomatic effort will succeed.
But what will that do for the original intent that you said that we're not focusing on, which is the civil war?
My fear is that we will continue to ignore it. It'll take care of itself. I mean, it's absolutely certain that the country is war weary, right?
And either way, the position of the United States in the eyes of the rest of the world, weaker, stronger?
No, well, you know, I'm a veteran of the Vietnam War, which was supposed to have destroyed the American credibility very, very seriously. The fact of the matter is the United States is the United States, and everybody has to live with it.
Good, bad, or indifferent.
Right.
Or that the forgettery works pretty well, even if something goes terribly wrong. There's always a chance for a redemption.
Well, one of the things Winston Churchill is supposed to say is that the Americans always do the right thing after they've tried everything else.
All right. We're going to leave it at that one and see whether the right thing happens or not. Dr. Brian Hallett, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Hallett is an associate professor at the Matsunaga Institute for Peace at the UH. We'll talk to you tomorrow morning for The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Have a good evening. Aloha.